Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Hope your holiday season is going along nicely. We have a great show lined up for you today. I've got joining me momentarily Mr. Andy Friedman. Andy is a political commentator. You've probably seen him on CNBC. We'll be getting his opinion as to what's happened here with the recent spending bill compromise. We'll talk to him in the first and last segment of today's program. Also joining me on today's program is the president of DownsizeDC.org, Mr. Jim Babka. I'll be chatting with him in the second and third segment of today's program. You know, we're all about providing you a different perspective and additional resources, and I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you about some of the additional resources that are available to you in the form of Social Security Maximization Workshops. If you're not familiar, last month in November, almost 2 months ago now, the President and Congress agreed to change the way that you could collect Social Security. We talked about that in detail on a recent program with Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff. But if you're not familiar with what these changes are and how you might be affected, if you're between the ages of 55 and 65, I would encourage you to check out the website socialsecuritydinner.com. On the website is information about our free Social Security Maximization Workshops that include a free dinner at the close of the workshops. We've got three of them coming up in January. January 19 at the Highlands, January 21 at Stonewater, January 26 at Boulder Creek Golf Club. Again, just visit socialsecuritydinner.com for more information or to register. We also have our new retirement rules class coming up on January the 30th at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. You can get more information at newretirementrules.com. This class has been completely revised for 2016. So if you're thinking about making retirement planning a priority as one of your New Year's resolutions, I would encourage you to check out newretirementrules.com and register for the class there as well. I'm very excited to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Andrew Friedman. Andrew has been practicing law for more than 30 years. You've probably seen Andy on CNBC speaking about all things political. In fact, CNBC describes him as one of the nation's most sought-after speakers on all things political. His work can be read at his website, thewashingtonupdate.com, thewashingtonupdate.com. And Andy, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Andy, right now as we speak, and you mentioned this prior to us actually having our official recorded conversation here, that Congress is now voting on legislation to keep the government running. This seems like something that we hear every couple of years coming out of Washington. And included in this legislation, there's always some extra baggage or some surprises. So what's being considered this time and what's included in there that might affect our listeners?
Sure. And I would say in this case, most of the stuff in the legislation actually benefits your listeners. There's a number of provisions there that have expired at the end of last year and now are reinstated retroactively for this year and then are made permanent. So one, for instance, that advisors who are nearing retirement, I'm sorry, your listeners who are nearing retirement might care about is the ability of people over the age of 70 and a half to take up to $100,000 out of their IRA, have it go directly to a charity, and avoid all tax on that IRA distribution. And that can be their required minimum distribution for the year. So that now that charitable contributions typically are subject to phase-outs and deductions, this is a great deal, because money that goes straight from your IRA to a charity has no phase-out. You get a full deduction. So I would advise your listeners, we have another couple weeks remaining this year, and then you have next year. If you're over 70 and a half and charitably minded, take advantage of this provision. It makes a lot of sense to be able to make the contributions out of your IRA. Again, only for people over 70 and a half. Some of the other things that are in there help small businesses, enhanced write-offs for capital assets, including an immediate write-off for capital assets for small, certain capital assets for small businesses, bonus depreciation, things like that. As far as the market's concerned, the legislation lifts a 40-year-old prohibition on exports of domestically produced oil. So the oil companies in the U.S. now have a much larger market to be able to sell their oil, and I would expect that could result in a change in oil prices as we see what the foreign demand is. And then finally, for your listeners that have 529 plans to finance their kids' education or their grandkids, now you can use that money also to help students buy computers and other technology. So we have an expansion of the benefits of 529 plans. So that's kind of an overview of some of the things in there. If you want to talk about it more, and I'll just leave this to you, we can talk a bit about what happened in that legislation to Obamacare. The Republicans made an effort to cut back the sources of funding to that that may have some important effects there as well.
Well, let's revisit that because we've had prior guest experts here on the program that have discussed the fact that healthcare costs are just an ever-growing component of, or it's becoming a lot greater percentage of GDP, and that trend has to reverse. So maybe this is the beginning of such a thing. What are they talking about as far as cutting back funding, as far as the Affordable Care Act is concerned?
Well, I mean, it's not. It's obviously the Affordable Care Act cannot get repealed under the current political situation. You have a Democrat in the White House, not going to allow that. So the Republicans who feel that the legislation is maladaptive have been instead trying to cut back on the money that the government can use to finance the implementation of Obamacare. So there's really four things that the legislation does, and I won't take you into the weeds on this, but there's a tax, something called the Cadillac tax, that was going to hit on plans that were too lucrative. It was a confiscatory 40% tax. That got pushed off till 2020. The medical device tax, a new tax on medical devices, got pushed off till 2018. And an additional tax that insurers have to pay when they issue policies under the ACA also got pushed back till 2018. And finally, the law, maybe people didn't realize this, but the law actually as written said that if insurance companies suffer losses as a result of insuring sick people, the government would reimburse them for those losses. That, too, essentially got changed so that there really will be many fewer reimbursements. The overall effect here is that the government will have less money to implement Obamacare, and that could have an effect. Whether it stops the increase in premiums on health care, that, I think, is much more doubtful.
Well, Andy, we have about one minute left in this segment. You'd mentioned that there was some changes on the laws potentially on exporting oil.
Yeah.
What effect will that have on U.S. GDP? Could that turn us into a net exporter versus a net importer?
I think so. I think that the oil companies, you know, have been restricted. So that when they sold oil, it had to be to U.S. businesses. And the Democrats like that because it keeps manufacturing here. Businesses have a less expensive access to oil. Now that that's going overseas, I think there's kind of two effects that go in different directions. It helps oil companies. They'll be able to get a higher price for their oil because they can sell it to the highest bidder all around the world. So that helps their revenue. That helps GDP. On the other hand, it becomes more expensive for U.S. manufacturers now to employ oil because they're going to have to pay the higher price that the world is paying. So, again, I think one would say it benefits the oil companies, which is what the Republicans wanted to do. The Republicans believe in more free trade, fewer barriers, as, you know, just an overall position. Democrats, you know, are concerned that it will make it more expensive to manufacture here.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. We're chatting today with Mr. Andy Friedman. His website is The Washington Update. That's T-H-E, thewashingtonupdate.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. We'll continue talking to Andy after these words. Stay with us. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the program today, Mr. Jim Babka. I always enjoy my conversations with Jim, who is president of the organization DownsizeDC.org. And Jim, welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
It has been a while, but I'm glad to really be back.
Jim, for our listeners that may be new listeners and maybe are not familiar with your organization, explain what Downsize DC does.
Downsize DC gives people a chance to communicate with their representative and two senators in a way that that office knows that they're hearing from a constituent. We send out action items about things that that Congress is about to do and or is doing, and we provide sample letters that people can use to send. And the purpose of this process is to attract as many people as possible who are going to band together because there is strength in numbers. And we do this, you know, 2 to 3 times a week minimum, sometimes 5 times a week, at downsizedc.org. The focus of it matches very strongly with our name. We believe that the government should be no larger at a max than the Constitution would allow, but and even in some cases even smaller than that, because we think that voluntary actions by individuals working together with one another generally achieve more and do less harm or violence in the process. So the website is downsizedc.org, and we encourage people to come check it out.
Well, I do check it out. I would encourage listeners to do the same. Jim, you made a comment that the government should be no bigger than the Constitution allows, and yet it seems that the Constitution is maybe all but forgotten, except for when it's convenient. Would you agree with that statement?
I would agree with that statement wholeheartedly and completely, and I think we could even go one step further and say that to some degree the Constitution itself has failed us. It's a mistake to assume that we would give so much power to a group of people and they would not try to figure out a way to then build or rig a system for themselves where they would continue to constantly expand that power. And this has been true of both Republican and Democrat parties. Both of them have, in various areas, sought to expand the power that they have for their own private benefit and also to get elected. They have appealed to people through a variety of bread and circuses and other bad acts, maybe even safety, to try to get people to believe that somehow or other they can protect them, they can make their lives easier, they can lift the burdens off your shoulders, and it will be virtually free. And unfortunately, far too many of us have consented to this government. And so we try to alert people to what is happening and when it's happening and encourage them to take actions that will begin to roll back the size of the government.
Jim, I'm reminded as you're talking about how large government is and what a Herculean effort it's going to take to turn things around. And then I'm also reminded of the old cliche that if you're assigned the task of eating an elephant, you do so one bite at a time. So let me ask you, what are some of the bites that you're trying to take? What are some of your initiatives that are really at the top of your priority list?
Yeah, the thing that that we're probably best known for is our Read the Bills Act. We have some original pieces of legislation, and this is probably the one for which we're best known. And a few years ago, we were able to make this part of the national dialogue. But the Read the Bills Act is an idea that Congress should actually have to read its bills before it passes them. The act itself is a law, is binding upon Congress, and I'll explain how it's enforced in just a moment. But the way it works is it says that every member, before they want to cast a yes vote, to spend more money, to create a new law or program, reauthorize a program, they have to have signed an affidavit saying that they have read the entire bill for themselves, or, failing that, that they have sat and listened to a literal word-for-word, in order, start-to-finish reading of the bill. That requirement, by the way, is also included, that the quorum, which the Constitution defines as 50% plus one of the members, has to sit and listen to this literal word-for-word, in order, reading of the bill. And we do that because the bills are far too long, they cover far too many things, and they are far too many of them for people to keep up with. And so we are insisting that Congress basically do less. We are downsized D.C., after all, and we think if they have to sit through these long readings, they will produce fewer and shorter bills. But we don't stop there. We also believe that it's important, like for talk show hosts like yourself, Dennis, for watchdog groups like ourselves, Downsized D.C., for everybody that's listening right now, to be able to read the bill as well. And so we say that once that process is complete, there is a 7-day waiting period during which the bill has to be posted online for all of us to be able to read. Now, if Congress fails to follow these provisions, there's no way we can send them to jail or anything like that, but we can make it so that the law is of no effect. If you find yourself in the dock, you're being charged with something, you violated the law in some way, and you're in court, you can present the evidence to the judge that Congress did not follow the procedures spelled out in this law, and the judge throws out the case with impunity, meaning it can't be brought back up against you again. And so if they want to pass laws where they don't follow this process, if they want to waste their time and spin their wheels, then let them. But this process would provide a method by which the American people could enforce some kind of behavior on what is perhaps the most anarchic institution in the country, the U.S. Congress, a body that makes its own rules and then doesn't follow them.
Jim, you know, that act seems like it should be easily embraced by almost everyone. It's so full of common sense. In fact, I had Ron Paul on the program not long ago, and the whole idea of auditing the Fed seems like it's just a lot of common sense, and it seems like nobody would object to it. And yet, it seems like a lot of special interests get involved, and these common sense ideas that would seem to benefit everybody just don't get any traction. So what kind of traction have you gotten with this Read the Bills Act?
Well, you know, it's rather interesting because the proposal that we put out is what we call transpartisan, and by that I mean it extends across all party lines. It doesn't seem to know a bound. And as I've been out over the years talking about this subject, number one, I have not found a single radio host, no matter where they're at on the political spectrum, that has not thought that this bill wasn't either a good idea or a just fantastic idea. Everyone has agreed with it. And I would say that north of 90% of the people that I've spoken to have had one of two responses. Either they've said, yes, this is something that should be done, or, wait a minute, Congress doesn't read their bills because they just didn't know. And then, of course, after they get the details, they say, oh, of course, this should be done. So it doesn't seem to know a party line, but it does seem to know a geographic line, and that is that somehow or other, right around the time you get around the Washington, D.C. beltway, all of a sudden there is a large pocket of resistance, probably where it matters most. And over the years, people have come to believe that you know, if we want to do something and they don't want to go along, that there's no way we can get things done. And it's kind of unfortunate and sad that we could have such widespread agreement. Everybody says common sense, but immediately they dismiss it as not very, very likely or possible, because they recognize implicitly, whether they know why this is the reason they recognize it or not, that Congress is about the power. And they're not going to give up anything that relates to that power. So, you know, we've kind of been, right now, the bill is introduced in the U.S. Senate. In the last term, it was in the House and the Senate, but the member of the House that introduced it is no longer there. And we're back, you know, looking to find sponsorship for it. And we've also been on other projects, which I'm going to talk to you about here shortly. But we are about to revive our press to get this back out of the national debate. It was a significant part of the national debate. Early in the Tea Party era, there were a lot of politicians that were out touting this idea, but many of them who were actually using the rhetoric were afraid to touch our bill because they recognized implicitly, even though they were supposedly fiscal conservatives, that they were not going to want their power taken away from them. They want to be able to get things done for people who were helping to back their campaign, the moneyed interests, as it were. And so we've got a lot of work ahead of us, but we've got a strategy we're going to adopt called picking off the herd. And as that strategy gets implemented, we expect to get even further with this bill than we did the first time we ran it out there.
Jim, the name immediately got my attention. Can you briefly explain what picking off the herd, what that strategy is? It's a great name.
Yeah, picking off the herd means that instead of trying to solve the problem all at once, you look at the Congress's, you know, 535 pieces of cattle. And I think this is completely fair, by the way, because they treat us like that. They milk us and slaughter us at will, too. So what we're saying is that, you know, maybe they don't need to get be able to hold their office or their popularity in their district anymore. And I'm actually envisioning a day, Dennis, where a congressman would come home to his district, and when he arrives to get on the local morning show, and he gets asked by the host, and even the callers want to know, when are you going to sponsor the Read the Bills Act? And he leaves, and he goes to a luncheon. And it's a luncheon for people in his own party because he's trying to draw support. And while there during the Q&A, he repeatedly gets pestered with questions about when he's going to sponsor the Read the Bills Act. And, of course, it's a holiday weekend that he happens to be home during, so he's going to participate in a parade. And while he's in that parade, there's people there with signs chanting, when are you going to sponsor the Read the Bills Act? And as if that's not bad enough, as he's driving home that night to see his wife, he hears a radio commercial and drives past a roadside sign, all saying, when is Congressman Foghorn going to sponsor the Read the Bills Act? And then when he gets home that night, he thinks he's finally achieved a place of sanctuary. He goes up to his bedroom. His wife's already in bed. He quietly slips off his clothes, crawls under the covers, goes to give his wife a kiss on the cheek, and she says to him, honey, when are you going to sponsor the Read the Bills Act? I want to create that much pressure for them. I want to make them that uncomfortable, but financially, the best way or the only way that we can really do this is probably one district at a time. We will pick off the herd.
Well, I would encourage the listeners to go check out your website at downsizedc.org, and we'll continue our conversation with Mr. Jim Babka when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure today of chatting with Mr. Jim Babka, who has been on the show before. I always look forward to my conversations with Jim. And in the last segment, we chatted a bit about downsizedc.org. And in this segment, Jim, I want to chat a little bit about your Zero Aggression Project. Can you start by explaining to the listeners what that is?
Well, the Zero Aggression Project is an attempt to get a central concept out there that we think could change everything, could really get our freedom back, and that is the notion of the Zero Aggression Principle. The Zero Aggression Principle, if you're looking for a bumper sticker version of it, is don't threaten or initiate force. But what it really means is that we need to limit all uses of force to defensive purposes, criminal justice, self-defense, etc. And we need to leave people free to follow their conscience, to pursue their happiness, provided they respect the equal rights of others. And we need to stop making political exceptions. Just because, you know, you and I can agree, or maybe a few more of us can agree, that we'd like to see X or Y be the policy, doesn't mean that we should be able to impose it on a neighbor who doesn't want to go along, who's living his life peacefully but making other choices. So if you and I don't have that power to go do that ourselves, we can't give that power to politicians either, even for the very best of intentions. Basically, we're saying, if you don't want people to tread on you, don't tread on others. And that's the Zero Aggression Principle, which basically says, don't threaten or initiate force.
So, Jim, explain what you're doing. I get emails on this all the time. There's some great articles that have been written about it. Explain how you're getting the message out.
Well, the Zero Aggression Project right now is basically composed of two tools, and these are designed to help you communicate these values and apply them. The first tool is something that we call mental levers. This is our attempt, and it will expand over time, to create a library, almost a lending book library, except instead of lending books, these are short articles, usually somewhere between 100 and 400 words long. That basically explain the voluntarist approach to libertarianism, the libertarian philosophy. The Zero Aggression Principle is essentially a libertarian idea. It's very pro-liberty. Your liberty, my liberty, your neighbor's liberty. And so we're presenting these ideas through these mental levers. These are short, bite-sized chunk articles that you can share with friends. They're particularly useful for sharing in social media. They give you the tools to say just the right thing at just the right time, because we've already provided the words for you. And we think it is also very important, Dennis, that people, instead of trying to argue these ideas, debate these ideas, raise their voice and call names especially, that instead they try a less aggressive approach, that they simply share these ideas, that they plant a seed. And, you know, there's a parable in the Bible that talks about planting the seed, but the person who plants the seed may not be the one who's there to weed and water, and still someone else may be along to come and get the harvest. We actually believe that sharing has to be done repetitively. It has to be done by more than one person. It needs to be accumulated over time until one day someone is sitting in front of their television set and something is said in the news, and the words that you spoke to them come out of their mouth as they're responding to what they hear on the TV. They've suddenly adopted your idea, but you're not there to see it. So we provided these mental lever tools for people to use, particularly as a lending library or in social media situations. The second tool that we have, we call right now polling campaigns. There's a button on the site called What Do You Think? We still have more plans for expanding how these work, but essentially they're designed to deal with what are called the exceptions. People make exceptions to this Zero Aggression Principle that it is wrong to initiate force and not very practical either. They say, well, okay, what about, you know, military conscription and the service and the draft, or what about drug prohibition, or what about this issue or that? And so we are building a collection of those as well, where people can come in and they can participate. And it's designed to be kind of a interactive or engaging, even maybe fun, way of interacting, because as you vote, you get to see how other people vote on the arguments that are being presented to you. The arguments are framed around the Zero Aggression Principle. They talk about actually how the Zero Aggression Principle could be violated in this particular case. And if that's not enough, we have something we call the check writing question, which basically asks, if instead of the money being taken from you, as it's presently taken, in the form of taxes, you had to sit down, like you do for all of your other bills and your favorite charities, and at the end of that process decide whether or not you're going to write a check for Program X, would you write the check? And if you still would, then we actually ask you, we actually show you the ways that this program costs, the violence that's done that people can't see, things that we don't get or to have because of the program. We show the true and full cost of what the program does so that you can, again, assess whether or not it would really be worth sitting down and writing the check. Because, Dennis, I think most people, most of the time, think that, well, my money's already going off to Washington. And so it becomes very easy to pretend that all government programs are basically free beyond that. It's an unlimited pot. It's not going to cost me anymore. Why don't they do X? Why don't they do Y? Why don't they do Z? Because these are basically good ideas. But if they have to, if we can change their frame of mind in some ways, and I would encourage people to come check out at zeroaggressionproject.org, click on What Do You Think, pick one of those campaigns, how we frame these arguments, because I'm just barely scratching the surface of how we do this, is designed to get people to look at these programs and these laws and regulations in a completely different way, largely framed around this zero aggression principle concept.
Jim, this whole idea of a zero aggression principle seems to really be going against the prevailing trend. You read so often about how regulatory authorities can take enforcement action, often denying people due process. It seems that there's more force being used now as opposed to less force being used. How do you think this will get traction? It seems like it's really counter-trend, or would you not agree with that?
I do think there's a reason to think that it is counter-trend, and I also think there's reason to think it'll get worse before it gets better, because, you know, as the state continues to go through its death rattle, it's going to do more and more dramatic things to try to assert its power and its survival, and even its growth. There are people who are profiting off this system. Milton Friedman identified a long time ago, and this is a large part of the reason we created Downsize DC, was to turn this very formula I'm about to share on its head, that there was a problem of concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. In other words, the people who are benefiting from the programs benefit tremendously and have a tremendous incentive to show up and lobby and promote and fund the candidates who will bring them what they want. But the people who are paying for these programs are very, very dispersed. The costs are spread very, very widely. And their ability to stop these programs from passing would require an extraordinary amount of effort and time, far more than what they're paying for them. And there are so many battles to fight that they cannot keep up with them all. The cost to you for a particular government program might be a penny or a nickel or a dime or a quarter or even a dollar a day, a month, a year. And so why would you take the time? Because any time you spent fighting would probably cost more than what it costs for you to pay for the program. And worse, and this concept in public choice theory is called rational apathy, you suspect you're going to lose, so you choose instead not to care about that, but to care about something that's actually closer to home and matters to you more, and that may even be something as simple as the local sporting event. But you decide to care about that instead because you feel that powerless, that out of control, and it's just too many battles to fight, too many ways to lose. So we tried to, and Downsize DC, to turn that on its ear. Now, I would say I'm overall, Dennis, an optimist. So getting back on the road to your question, I would say that we see more and more people understanding this idea and moving in an empathetic direction. They're beginning to recognize the fundamental humanity of their neighbor and the harm that the state does. So while the government is acting worse than perhaps it ever has, at a very local level, beneath the radar, more and more people are opening up their eyes to these ideas. And if we would have attempted to introduce something like the Zero Aggression Project 8, 9 years ago, I don't think we would have had anybody or really any traction. But now we have people who do recognize it more than I can ever recall. And I've been involved in this and promoting an idea. This idea has kind of been central to my thinking for a very long time, although we've been talking more about Downsize DC since 1996. Professionally, and there are more people now who understand this idea, agree with this idea, want to move in the direction of the zero aggression principle than I can ever recall. So I have reason to hope.
Well, Jim, we've got a little over a minute left in this segment. You mentioned that there's reason to believe that things may get worse before they get better. And I know you don't endorse any political candidates, but was that an inadvertent commentary on the current election cycle?
It's an inadvertent commentary on virtually that, and also our financial system, which is in a lot of trouble. The government continues to spend at incredible rates. And, you know, one of the things that's not being talked about very much, I know you addressed this, but it's not being talked about near enough, is the level of trouble that Social Security is in. It's in huge amount of trouble. And for a guy my age, I happen to be 47, I think there's a reasonable expectation that some form, however modest, of default is going to arrive within the next 15 to 20 years, and maybe sooner. And so, will it be a full default? No, probably not. They'll find ways to pace this over, but it's going to be a very difficult situation we have coming down the pike. And if you want a clue as to what it might start to look at, like, look at this government of Illinois and what they're going through right now with lottery payments and pensions and so forth. I think there's going to be some issues and difficulties coming because they simply cannot stop the spending. And one more thing on this, the Republicans themselves are to blame for this. They've known this is a problem. They've campaigned on the notion that this is a problem. And yet they just pushed the President of the United States into spending more than $100 billion beyond the spending caps that they designed a couple of years ago to try to begin to rein in the spending. So I think that's real reason to be concerned that both the political parties and their candidates, which are horrible from my personal perspective, and our financial system are in trouble.
We're going to have to leave it there. And interestingly, we just talked about the problems with Illinois' pension system on last week's program. So that's a very timely comment. Our guest today has been Mr. Jim Babka of Downsize DC. I would encourage you to check out the organization's work at downsizedc.org. And I would also encourage you to get involved and support them. Jim, thanks for being on the program.
Always a pleasure, Dennis.
We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am chatting today with Mr. Andy Friedman. If you're just joining us, Andy's website is thewashingtonupdate.com. That's T-H-E, thewashingtonupdate.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. You've probably seen Andy talking about all things political on CNBC, and he's going to be doing the same in this segment of the Everything Financial Radio program. So, Andy, obviously approaching another political season. What's your assessment as to what's happened so far, both on the Republican and Democratic side, as far as the presidential contest is concerned?
Well, let's start with the Democrats. I've been saying for well over a year that Hillary Clinton would get the nomination, and I think it's pretty clear that will happen, unless one of two things could derail her. And one is, I don't expect either of these to happen, but they're still out there. One is that we learn of some new perceived transgression, completely apart from Benghazi or the emails, that people just say, you know what, that's too much. And I'm not aware of any such thing, but that would change it. Secondly, if somebody close to her were indicted over the email scandal, that I think also would be very serious. And the FBI is doing that investigation. The director of the FBI is a Republican, not a Democrat, so I think it will be a fair investigation. He's known for fairness. I don't think anything will come out of it that serious, but if it does, that's a problem for her. Otherwise, I expect she'll sail into the nomination. Obviously, for the Republicans, it's a lot more complicated. Trump has really roiled the race. It's interesting. I feel he would not be a strong general election candidate. You know, you look at the polls, 60% of Republicans support him on his positions, and that number reverses when you talk about the general population. So 40% is not enough to win an election. I think that would be a struggle for him. I think the greatest concern about Trump, if you're a Republican, is that he runs as an independent. You know, he keeps talking about, well, I won't, I will, I won't, I will, but it's very easy to see him saying, the Republican Party didn't treat me right, I'm not going to be stuck with that vow I promised, and I'm going to run as an independent. If he does that, then the Republicans will lose the election. I still believe he will not be the candidate. When it comes time to pull the lever, I don't think he will win Iowa or New Hampshire, and I think that could slow his momentum. Just quickly on some of the other candidates, Ben Carson, I think really you're seeing his campaign unravel. You know, he's a very bright man, articulate, of course, as were really pretty much everybody on the stage last night or the night before. But he just doesn't have the expertise, particularly in the foreign policy area, and I think that's showing. I don't expect he's going to get much further. The two candidates that I think you have to watch on the Republican side, and this won't surprise you, are Rubio and Cruz. If you ask the Democrats who do they fear most, they would say Rubio. Rubio would be a very strong general election candidate, I believe. He talks about defense and foreign policy. He stayed above the fray in discussions about some of these conservative social issues that are more divisive when you get to a general election. So I think he's done very nicely. Cruz, incredibly articulate, again, very smart, by his own definition, very conservative. He would be a much tougher general election candidate for the Republicans. I don't know if people realize this, but 42% of our country now is independent. They're not Republican or Democrat. And they're looking for compromise, typically, and pragmatism out of Washington. And if I go back to the first debate, Ted Cruz said, if you want to send a guy to Washington who's going to compromise, I am not your guy. And that's a direct quote. That is not a statement that is going to appeal to independents. So my feeling is that somebody like Rubio would put the party in a good position, or at least the best position they can be in the general election. Now, look, there's no doubt the demographics favor the Democrats. They have less far to go to get over 270 votes in the Electoral College. But, you know, it's very much a contest of personalities. And if the Republicans get the right personality up there, they could do quite well.
So, you know, when you look at a Trump and a Carson, obviously political outsiders,
yep.
To what extent do you attribute at least their early success to the fact that, you know, folks are just totally fed up with what's going on in Washington?
Oh, I think it has a tremendous amount to do with that. And, you know, I can't blame them. You know, you let off the segment with Congress has passed a bill to keep the government running. I mean, how silly is that, right, that we have to come down to midnight on the day that money has to be appropriated to the government, and if it's not, the federal government shuts down, which you'll remember happened a couple years ago. I mean, that's crazy stuff. And so instead of focusing on the larger issues that have to be addressed, like tax reform, entitlement reform, military spending, we end up with these lurching from a manufactured date when something has to happen to the next manufactured date when something crucial has to happen. So I don't, you know, I can completely understand why people are incredibly frustrated with what's happening in Washington. And when Trump says things like, you know, I'm going to shake it up down there and get things done, that resonates with a lot of people because they feel nothing's getting done.
So Andy, when you talk about tax reform and talk about entitlement reform, and let's just start with tax reform.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a number of candidates that I can recall, particularly on the Republican side,
mm-hmm.
That have said we need a flat tax, and they all think it's a great idea. But once they get to Washington, it seems like reform just doesn't happen. So can real tax reform get done?
Well, if you get a Democratic president, the answer is no, I believe, because you're going to have the Republicans are going to hold the House for the rest of this decade and probably the next decade as well. So it's going to be very hard for a Democratic president and a Republican House, and then the Senate, depending on how that ends up, to come up with tax reform. I mean, Democrats typically believe the opposite of a flat tax, that the wealthy can afford to pay more, and that tax rates on the wealthy probably should be increased. Republicans, of course, feel exactly the opposite. And then you have the issue of, you know, how are you going to pay for all this? If you're going to drop the top tax rate precipitously and not lose revenue, you're going to have to start attacking some of the sacred deductions and exemptions that we're used to. And you see the proposals making suggestions about whether you can deduct mortgage interest or whether you get tax-exempt interest on muni bonds. And those are hugely controversial points. Now, if you had a Republican president and the Republicans keep the Senate, then I think there's a possibility of trying to work out some deal. Now, obviously, various industries are going to be upset by what's done. If they say, like, the oil industry loses a lot of its benefits under the tax code, which is what would normally happen if you're simplifying it. But I think it's possible in that case. Very hard if you have a Democratic president or Republican House.
Let's talk about entitlement reform. We've got a couple minutes left in this segment. You know, it seems like whenever you talk about Social Security and Medicare, the big two entitlement programs, obviously the math is such that at a certain point, things will have to change. Is this can, in your view, going to continue to just be kicked down the proverbial road, or will somebody stand up and say, let's fix this?
Well, you know, I think everybody says it needs to be fixed, but you hit the nail on the head, Dennis, that people don't agree on what to do. By way of background, quickly, two-thirds of all federal spending is entitlement spending and interest on the debt, which means it's mandatory. Those payments have to go out every single year. And that's growing, right? As people age, now you add Obamacare costs into that. Entitlement spending's growing. And everybody knows how to fix it. You know how, I know how. You know, you push back the retirement age a bit. Maybe you have to do some means testing so wealthy people get their money back but don't get more than what they put in. You probably have to subject more wages to Social Security taxes. That's probably a small part of it. But then you throw it out there, and the Democrats say, we're not pushing back the retirement age. The Republicans say, we're not going to raise wage taxes, and we don't go anywhere. So quickly, what I think has to happen is some sort of what I call a forcing event, something that requires Congress to act. And what that seems to me to be, that as we keep issuing more and more debt every year to cover our deficits, people buying that debt, or China and Japan, aren't going to be satisfied with 2 or 3% interest. They're going to say, we're looking at your fiscal situation, it's not improving, we want higher interest. Once that happens, and this is down the road, but once that happens, then Congress has to act, because we can't let the world worry about whether we can pay that interest. We have to cut entitlements. And if you think about it, that's exactly what happened in Europe. You know, creditors of those countries say, we don't like your fiscal situation, we won't buy your debt. Interest rates spike, and they have to cut entitlements. And I fear that's ultimately what happens here.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Andy Friedman. Andy's website is thewashingtonupdate.com. That's thewashingtonupdate.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. Andy, thanks for joining us. Love to have you back.
Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate it.
Well, that concludes our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. I'd like to remind you of a couple additional educational resources that are available to you. You can go to socialsecuritydinner.com. and get more information about our Social Security maximization workshops that we're holding in light of the recent Social Security collection changes passed by Congress and signed into law by the President. We have three workshops coming up in January, all beginning at 6 and concluding with a free dinner at 7:30. January 19 will be at the Highlands Golf Club, January 21 at Stonewater Country Club, and January 26 at Boulder Creek Golf Club. Again, more information or to register, go to socialsecuritydinner.com. And our new retirement rules class, if you've not yet attended, I would strongly encourage you to do so. Our class will be held on January the 30th, which is a Saturday, at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. The cost for the class is just $49 for you and a guest. That includes the cost of lunch for both you and a guest, all the handouts, and the book that we send to you in advance of the class. If you're not sure why today's economy feels different, come to the class. We tell you why, and we give you some strategies to consider using in your portfolio in today's economic environment. We've gotten great reviews on the class. If you've not yet attended, I would encourage you again to do so. The website, newretirementrules.com. The website, again, newretirementrules.com. You can also go to everythingfinancialradio.com and listen to any of the interviews with our guest experts once again at any time you'd like. Again, that's our program for this week. I hope you got something you can use. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye.